Well, here we are, gathered on this last day of Unleavened Bread, and it's hopefully been a very not only interesting but rewarding week for you. What did you learn about yourself this past week? What spiritual lessons, perhaps, did God show you? Not looking for a show of hands, but did you slip up and eat something leavened this past week or find something? And then to kind of point it back to what we've heard so much today and even in this past week, who's ready to come out of Egypt? On this day in ancient Israel's history, they did leave Egypt behind, but there's another interesting event that happened on this day, if you will, in Israel's history that we may not think about much, but probably every one of us here is aware of it, and we'll get to that story in due course here as we progress. But what I'm going to do today is just review a few lessons, kind of following the theme, even as Mr. Knack did this morning, of just rehearsing some of the things maybe to keep in mind as we move forward, as we leave these days of spiritual learning for 2025, and consider some of the lessons that we should take with us. So as we get into some of this, let's kind of back up and look at some of Israel's history, again, as we've already covered to a degree, from their exodus in Egypt. We know from Exodus 12, we have that account of when God gave them instruction regarding the Passover. He told them to gather in their homes and to set aside a lamb, and then to kill it that evening, to roast it over fire, not leave their homes till morning. And as they killed that lamb, they were to take some of the blood and put it on the doorposts so that the angel of death would pass over them, hence the name of the evening. And so for us, 9 days ago, counting inclusively, we who are baptized gather to keep that observance following the New Testament symbols. We rehearse that as Christ gave for the keeping of it, the foot washing, the bread, the wine, and each of the gospel accounts record various aspects of this event. And then to consider in that evening, to ponder the verses that we read and to be reminded of Christ being our Passover, the Lamb of God sacrificed before the foundation of the world for our sins. This was always God's plan, knowing that we were weak and temporary, but needing to be so that we would grow in character. We see through those symbols then that we took that evening of Christ living in us, dwelling in us, sustaining us, and so our nature can change, our carnal nature, into godly character. So once we have our sins paid for through the blood of Christ, then we're to yield to Him for our deliverance from this world, for our changing of character, to becoming like Him and His Son. And so then to go back to the children of Israel, when they started their journey out of Egypt, it was on that first day of unleavened bread. And as it says, they went out with a very high hand. They were just so thrilled after 400 plus years of being slaves, of the onerous nature of the untold deaths, that they were finally going to be liberated. But as they began this past week as a type of walking out of Egypt, they were not out of the clutch of Egypt's hand. Pharaoh had a change of heart even after the death of the firstborn and the decimation that must have caused within that nation. They realized what they were losing in terms of free manpower and the control over these people. But it was only then, when Pharaoh's army was drowned, that they were finally free from being pulled back. Now, they took some of Egypt with them, unfortunately, but at least in terms of a setting, they were not there anymore, because they still had their own desires to change. It's interesting to recount as you read through Exodus especially, but the balance of the Pentateuch, how many times they said they wanted to go back to Egypt. They forgot all the hard labor. They forgot the meager food rations. They forgot the deaths, even of the young baby boys, all of that. They forgot all of that, and they simply wanted to not have to grow, not have to confront these things. And so they came to this last day, before that even took more root, they came to this last day of this Days of Unleavened Bread, and God performed a very mighty miracle on their behalf. We'll come to that again as we progress a little bit further on later. But it's interesting that He provided the means for them to just walk out. God could have done it in so many different ways. He could have broken Pharaoh's power in other ways. He could have had another army come in. He could have just many other different ways He probably could have done this. But they had to be part of the process. they needed to be part of the process. And there's great debate in theological circles, historical circles, scholars on what route the Israelites would have taken out. But even God pondered, if you will, a little bit and said, I don't want them to go the way of the Philistines, because if they happen to have to fight these Philistines, they're going to be discouraged and overwhelmed. They're going to want to go back even more. And so he took them out through what now is called the Sinai Peninsula and crossed the Red Sea. It wasn't the Bitter Lakes, as some will say. That's just a very shallow area, easily walked through without even water being parted. But the problem was that it needed to be a big enough body of water, if you will, that they felt trapped. And we see that later, don't we? They had put themselves into essentially a box canyon, mountains on both sides, Pharaoh's army behind them, and this massive water body in front of them they couldn't pass on their own. But then God did provide a means, didn't he? Always found that interesting. Were they picking fish up along the way as they walked? Maybe fish that came out of the water, or was it like an aquarium where they could just view all the fish as they walked by? But as they came out on the other side, they still weren't done with their walk, were they? They traveled close to 200 miles to Succoth. And that's quite a feat with the number of people that were traveling together. They, I'm sure, had wagons that they had spoiled as well, but you've got elderly people, you have animals, you have small children. You're not going to move that group of people very quickly. And so even if they cross the Red Sea, it takes time to accomplish things. It takes time to move forward. It takes time to come out of even a situation like they were in Egypt. But let's go back to Exodus 14 and just kind of rehearse some of this account. We've touched on various verses of this today, but I want to go through it a little more deeply, even though we may not read the whole chapter here, but hit more of some of the spots within it. So in chapter 1, God directs Moses to lead the children of Israel through Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, opposite Baal-Zephon, and to camp there. He was deliberately, God, having them, even at this point, wander a little bit, because he wasn't done with Pharaoh. And so we see this even in verse 2. It says, for Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, they are bewildered by the land. The wilderness has closed them in, right? They don't know where they're going. You know, as slaves, they wouldn't have traveled widely. So they're lost, you know. So he says, God does, I will harden Pharaoh's heart so that he will pursue them and will gain honor over Pharaoh and all of his army. And so we even found that perhaps this past week in our own personal circumstances. Doesn't always mind what we want to do. Satan in life circumstances also can have other plans, can't they? So we may have cleaned our homes as best as we thought. And then later in the week, that most obvious piece of leaven was right in front of us that we just didn't see. Or we opened something, a drawer or a part of our car we may not normally access, whatever it was. And so sin can, in that respect, pursue us, can't it? And this is what Pharaoh is doing here. This is a lesson that God is showing them. Even though originally he thought he was done, Pharaoh wasn't going to let go. And so verse 5, we see this. They essentially said, we made a mistake. Pharaoh and all of his servants. And so he gathers this army. In verse 6, he takes 600 chariots. Verse 7, with all their captains, his whole army. Everybody's called up. Everybody's mobilized there after this, because this is going to be a huge loss to the country economically and many other ways. And so verse 8, again, God hardens the heart of Pharaoh, and he pursued them even more. Now, these are military men. These are fit men. These are men with horses and chariots. They're going to move a lot quicker than a nation of people traveling on wagons with old people and children and animals. And so they overtake them. Verse 10, Pharaoh drew near. The children of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them, and they were very afraid, and they cried out to the Eternal. All of that, perfectly understandable. Right? They didn't expect to see Pharaoh ever again. And then here he is, the dust cloud that's following him, and they know the might of the Egyptian army, and it's very concerning to them. But notice verse 11. We touched on this earlier today. What was their response? Crying out to God, please protect us. Please help us. Please give us strength. Give us safety. Any number of things. No, what they go to is, you sent us out here to kill us, didn't you? Were there no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? And then verse 12. I have to wonder if they even said this. Read a little bit of revisionist history maybe here. Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, let us alone? I don't remember that when they were spoiling the nation. I don't remember that when the babies and the firstborn of all the herds and everybody households, when they were dying. I don't remember any of that being recorded. But notice verse 13. Moses says to them, do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Eternal. That's a challenging thing, isn't it? Because again, you've this world-ruling empire army pursuing you. You know what they're capable of. And it doesn't look like you have any recourse. And you're simply going to say, just wait. Just hold on. Just wait. Notice verse 14. The Eternal will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace. And so he tells Moses in verse 16, lift up your rod, stretch out your hand over the sea, and divide it, and the children of Israel shall go on dry land through the midst of the sea. Now, I don't know if you've ever been around a body of water that's been evacuated. Maybe an old pond that needs to be drained because it's just filled up with so much silt or whatever, and you dig out one end, and what little water is in there drains out. What's left? Just all the muck and the mud. There's nothing that's going to travel through that. Can you imagine what the bottom of that Red Sea looked like? What the mire was like? And then God sends this wind to dry it out overnight. They've got to wait another night yet. Right? But this steady wind, like a fan blowing on water on a floor that'll eventually dry. And so they travel through. They walk through this marvelous sight. I can only imagine the questions all the kids were asking their parents. I would have questions. And they get to the other side, and then verse 21, Moses stretches out his hand over the sea, and the Eternal caused the sea to go back by a strong wind at the night, made the sea into dry land, the waters were divided, and they went through the midst of it, verse 22, and the Egyptians pursued them. Right? Well, it's good enough for them. We can follow. But it came to pass, verse 24, in the morning that the Eternal looked down the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and the cloud and troubled the army of the Egyptians. And he took off their wheels. So they drove them with difficulty. And the Egyptian says, let us flee. Their plan was going sideways really quick. We need to get out of here. In verse 26, God tells Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea that the waters may return on the Egyptians, their chariots and their horsemen. And Moses did this. And this almost probably thunderous clap of this water as it came together with all the force and energy that it had. So verse 28, the waters returned, covered the chariots, the horsemen, all the army of Pharaoh came to the sea after them. Not so much as one of them remained. Which goes to the point of young Mr. Knapp's sermonette message about the Ten Commandments. If you remember that account, only Pharaoh is standing on the side. No, he died with all the rest of them. But 29, verse 29, the children of Israel had walked on the dry land in the midst of the sea, and the waters were a wall to them on the right and the left, and the Eternal saved Israel that day out of the hand of the Egyptians. Verse 31, thus Israel saw the great work which the Eternal had done, and they feared the Eternal. At least for now, they feared him. But let's switch gears a little bit and go to Joshua chapter 3, and this is the other account that I alluded to. So Israel, in the account that we just covered, went through the Passover evening, as we rehearsed from the New Testament symbols, first day of unleavened bread, left Egypt, began their journey out, last day of unleavened bread was the account that we just read in Exodus 14, as they were finally done with the powers of Egypt. And we come to an interesting thing then, 40 years later, Joshua 3, after all the wanderings, the initial rebellion that God had said, because it had taken them about 40 days to get to the promised land, but they rebelled, didn't they? They didn't listen to God. They didn't trust God. He said, okay, fine. For every day that you walked here, I'll give you another year of wandering. So for 40 years, they wandered about in the wilderness. And then they come to the edge of the promised land. Joshua 3 in verse 1, it says, Joshua rose early in the morning, and they set out from the acacia grove, came to Jordan, and all the children of Israel had lodged before they crossed over the river. This is the Jordan River. They're going into the land that God had promised to Abraham and his descendants. So it was, after 3 days, the officers went through the camp, and they commanded the people, saying, when you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Eternal, your God, and the priests and the Levites, bearing it, then you shall set out from your place and go after it. Let's move down to verse 14. So it was, when the people set out from the camp to cross over the Jordan, with the priests bearing the Ark and the Covenant before the people, and those who bore the Ark came to the Jordan, and the feet of the priests who bore the Ark dipped in the edge of the water. So the men that are carrying this, they had staves that went through the rings on the sides of the Ark of the Covenant, and they're carrying this, and as soon as the front two men stepped in the water, it says here, the edge of the water that flows, overflows its banks, so this is just swollen water too, this is not middle of August when the water level is going to be the lowest, that the waters which came down for the upper stream stood still and rose in a heap very far away at Adam, the city that is beside Zeratan. So the waters went down into the sea of the Arabah, the salt sea, failed and were cut off, and the people crossed opposite Jericho. So God essentially repeats the same thing, doesn't he? Now, it's not a water wall of water on either side, because this is not a lake. This is not a big body of water, like an ocean, a finger of a part of the ocean. This is a flowing stream. So he stops it on one side, and the other side just keeps draining. But they have this dry land in front of them now, where it had been this swollen stream, river, that had been flowing with overflowing. But God stopped it again, didn't he? Just like he parted the Red Sea. So let's move over to chapter 5, Joshua chapter 5 and verse 10. They're moving into the land. It says, the children of Israel camped at Gilgal, and they kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month at twilight in the plains of Jericho. So all of this preceded the Passover. They're now in the promised land. They're now before Jericho at this time, 9 days ago that we observed, day of Passover. And so they move down to verse 13. It says, it came to pass when Joshua was by Jericho that he lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, a man stood opposite him with his sword drawn in his hand. Now, that would probably raise a few eyebrows, I would think, I would hope. Suddenly this man shows up. And the way it is here, this is not just some random guy that shows up at the edge of your camp. There seemed to be a presence here. So Joshua essentially says, as Moses did at the burning bush, I'm going to go check this out. We want to see what this guy has to say. And this is the question he asks him in verse 13. Are you for us or for our adversaries? What is your intentions? And so this man answers, he says, no, but as the commander of the army of the Eternal, I have now come. And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshipped and said to him, what does my Lord say to his servant? This is not an angel. How do I know it's not an angel? Because he's worshiping him. Every other time in Scripture that happens, they all say, don't do that. So this is Jesus Christ. So Joshua falls before him, and he says, what does my Lord say to his servant? I'm here. What do you need me to do? So it says, the commander of the Eternal's army said to Joshua, take your sandal off your foot, and for the place you stand is holy. Just like the burning bush. Right? Joshua is standing before the presence of God, Christ incarnate. And so then we move into chapter 6. And God now gives Joshua the marching orders. Joshua said, what do you say to me? What do you need me to do? And so now God tells him, Jericho was securely shut up because the children of Israel, none went out, none came in. The word had gotten out. These people are moving into the countryside and they're taking everything. And so Jericho says essentially, yep, we got this covered. This is why we built the walls the way we did. Everybody come inside. We're going to bar the doors. And there's no way anybody can get in. We'll just wait them out. They'll get bored. They'll get tired. They'll move on. And so verse 2, the Eternal says to Joshua, see, I have given Jericho into your hand, its king and its mighty men of valor. You shall march. This is the battle plan. God says, I've given them to you. Here's what you do. March around the city. All your men of war, you shall go around the city once. You shall do this for 6 days. That's it. Right? There's no siege machines. There's no getting your men in certain troops or squads or whatever. There's no, you know, spying or penetrating, trying to test the resources. Just, you know, gather your men. And at the appointed time, you just walk around the city one time. That's it. You can go home. You can take a nap. So it says the seven priests shall bear the seven trumpets, ram horns before the ark. But the seventh day shall march around the city seven times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets. So they had the trumpets, they had the ark, they had the mighty men, they had walked around the city one time for 6 days, but on the seventh he says, now, we're going to change this up a bit. You're going to do that seven times, and then you're going to blow the horns. And it shall come to pass, when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, when you hear the sound of the trumpet, the people shall shout with a great shout. Right? There's no throwing of rocks, there's no heaving of spears, there's no attacking the city. Just shout. When you hear the trumpet blast, just shout. And so Joshua tells them all this. Verse 6, he says to the priests, take up the Ark of the Covenant, and seven priests bear seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of the Covenant. He tells the people, proceed and march around the city, and let him of his arm advance before the Ark of the Eternal. And so it was when Joshua had spoken to the people, the seven priests bearing the seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Eternal advanced and blew the trumpets. The Ark of the Covenant of the Eternal followed them. The army of the men went before the priests who blew the trumpets, and the rear guard came after the ark while the priests continued. And so he tells, Joshua makes this clear in verse 10. You shall not shout or make any noise with your voice, nor shall a word proceed out of your mouth until the day that I say to you, shout. So this must have been very perplexing to the Jericho residents. Seriously, this is their battle plan. You know, it probably became initially a point of curiosity. I can only, in my mind's eye, picture everybody on the walls. They're all lined up. It's like, look, what are they doing? And just watch them walk around the city, and then they go back to their tents. And the next day, the same thing. Maybe by the sixth day, it's like, oh yeah, I've seen that. And then the seventh day, it switches up, and they're still not sure what's going on. It must have been oddly unsettling to them. But then, it says they do this, verse 14, the second day up to the sixth, and verse 15, it comes to pass on the seventh day, they rose early, the children of Israel, about the dawning of the day, they marched around the city seven times in the same manner. On that day only did they march around the city seven times. And the seventh time it happened, the priests blew the trumpets. Joshua said to the people, shout, for the Eternal has given you the city. Now the city shall be doomed by the Lord to destruction. And we know what happened from there. The walls all crashed down. They've excavated Jericho. And one of the very interesting things about Jericho is that when walls fall, like with an earthquake, or even with armies attacking them, they're probably either going to fall in a pile or they're going to fall in to the city, right? The walls of Jericho fell out. So God, in many ways, is just repeating what he had done 40 years earlier. He's delivering them into the land now. He's giving them the promise that he'd given to Abraham. And this was probably, again, as I said, very unsettling to the inhabitants of Jericho. But by the time they may have even thought something was amiss, something is up, it's too late, isn't it? God had delivered the Jericho inhabitants into the land, into the hand of the Israelites. What I do find very reassuring in this account is that the Israelites followed God's instruction. And he did deliver them, as he promised, even back in Exodus 14. And it probably was something they scratched their head on, because it's like, wait a minute, let me see if I got this right. So God's going to give us this city, and for 6 days we just walk around the city one time. That's it, right? Yep, that's it. Don't say a word. Don't even whisper anything. Just, you know, just follow the ark. And then we'll do it again tomorrow for 6 days. And then on the seventh, we're going to do the same thing seven times. Then the trumpets are going to blow and we're going to shout. And everything's going to be done then, right? I mean, how do you picture that in your mind when that's never happened before? To try to understand, it's like, you know what? Fine, I'm just going to do it because I don't understand. I can't figure this out. I'll just do it. And so they did it. And this all happened. These 7 days were this past week. It was the Days of Unleavened Bread. Did they make the connection of coming out of sin and God removing these things? What are some of the things that we can learn from both of these accounts considering this past week? Well, following this, what I've just summarized, if you will, if we continue in Joshua 6 in verse 16, it talks about Rahab now in verse 17. Because the spies had gone in earlier. And the king and the officials figured something was up. Again, they heard that Israel was coming into the land. They'd heard these spies were in their city. They had tried to find them. If you remember the story, the account, Rahab had protected them and then let them out after the guards had come and so forth. And the spies told her, hang this out your window, bring everybody you love into your house, you'll be spared. And so she did. Which is an unusual thing to think about as well. She had no historical connection to Israel. She had no historical connection to the one we know as the eternal, the only true God. But there was something that drew her to all of this. And so she and her family were protected. The only part of the city not destroyed. Let's move forward to Joshua 22. Joshua 22 and in verse 5. Jericho had happened. Israel continued to move into the land. God had defeated king after king after king and removing them. They had begun to settle in the land. And if you remember when they had approached the Jordan, parts of 2.5 tribes had said, well, we like this side. Let us have this land. And Moses says, fine. You still have to help us conquer the rest of the land for the other tribes. And they said, okay, we'll do that. When we're done, we'll come back here. And they said, okay, fine. So this is the context here. These tribes are returning. So in Joshua 22 and verse 5, this is the admonition, the caution from Moses. He says, but be careful to take heed to do the commandment and the law which Moses, the servant of the Eternal, commanded you. And this is the commandment. To love God and keep his commandments, to hold fast to him, to serve him with all your heart and all your soul. Don't forget what God has done. Don't drift away. You're on this side of the Jordan. Don't forget you're part of this bigger family, this nation. Don't forget all that God had done for you. But this matter of keeping his commandments. So let's move to the New Testament, look at a couple of verses as well. In John chapter 14, perhaps, this was read where you were for Passover. But this is 14, 15, 16, 17 here of John. These chapters are the thoughts of Christ the night before his crucifixion. After the Passover service, if you will. And he's instructing the disciples. And so John 14, verse 15, just one verse here. He says to them, the disciples, this short sentence, if you love me, keep my commandments. We find this as well in 1 John 5, verses 2 and 3, the same sort of instruction. If you love me, keep my commandments. It's not a really difficult instruction, is it? Here they are. Follow them. All right, but we're never satisfied with that, usually. I shouldn't say never. We're rarely satisfied with that because it gets old, right? It gets boring. It gets stale. We just did that. And I have to wonder, going back to the account of the Israelites walking around Jericho, by the sixth day, they're probably saying, you know, once they're back in the camp, what are we doing? Well, we're following the instruction. Yeah, but what are we doing? We need to remember to allow God to fight the battles for us. That's one of the lessons of this past week. Right, I suspect many of them wanted to just get in there and get it done. Right, give me a sword. I'm gonna go in. God says we can have this land. I believe he's gonna protect me, deliver me, provide the means, and we'll just go in. We'll clean this all out. But that's not what God said. I'll give you the land. I want to know that you're going to honor me, follow me, and in this case, keep my commandments. Because I can't teach you, I can't bless you, I can't continue to work with you if you're not there. I mean, when you think about it, leavening is really kind of a silly thing to get rid of, isn't it? Why leavening? Well, we know why. It's just such a great illustration of how pervasive sin is, and at times just ubiquitous. I'll divulge for myself this past week, of all things I discovered leavening in, bottled water. Sodium bicarbonate they put in some bottled waters. Never looked at the ingredient level in a bottle of water because it's like water, right? What else do you put in there? Yeah, they put some sodium bicarbonate in there, probably for flavor. Okay, lesson learned. But it's just, it sneaks up on you, doesn't it? Even when you think you got it figured out, you don't have it figured out. And that's the caution, isn't it? In many ways, it's harder humanly to allow God to fight the battles for us. And it doesn't mean that we're not engaged. What was the instruction in Exodus 14? Stand still. Tell that to a three-year-old. Tell it to some adults, right? It's hard. And do what? Just stand still. Seriously? Yeah, just stand still. Just hold on. We get unsettled by that, don't we? We want to do things. We want to be in there. But it's not just standing still. This is why I wanted to read Joshua 25 and John 14. It's not just standing still. It's standing still doing my will. Keep my commandments. Follow my instruction. Internalize them. As we read in Deuteronomy 6, teach them to your children. Make this a part, a core part of who you are. And when we even look at God's instruction in Leviticus 23, he starts with the Sabbath, doesn't he? God draws people to him through his holy Sabbath day. And then what does he do? He leads them through his plan of salvation. But you're not going to understand his plan of salvation if you're not keeping the Sabbath day. You may understand bits and pieces of things here and there for whatever reason, but the picture is not going to be there. And then through the observance of those days, we understand and see more clearly the things that we need to learn more of, or the things we need to see more, even more clearly, or the things that we need to do differently to change behavior. So let's go back to Exodus 14. We read this verse, but I want to highlight it again, because I think it's truly powerful when we consider this past week and what it is that God looks at. That's not the way I want to say that, sorry. To consider our role versus God's role and how we have that relationship with him. Because humanly, we have these weaknesses. We're rarely balanced. We're too far this way. We're too far that way. We're in the ditches. You know, we have a hard time staying in the middle. We have a hard time staying balanced. We can have a lack of energy. We can have too much energy. We can be too quiet, we can be too loud, you know, just all these different things. But to have this relationship with God, to allow him to direct us. And so to go back to Exodus 14, and in verse 14 again, it says, "The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace." I just turned 65 last week, and I think I've learned... or at least seen more. I shouldn't say I've learned it yet. I've seen more about this in my life in the last 6 months than I've ever seen before. Because I don't want to stand still. You know, some conversations, you want to just be brutally honest and tell them what a knucklehead they are and how stupid they are. Right? My job would be easy if I didn't have to work with people. But this is worth remembering. The Lord will fight for you. How much spiritual leavening did we try to put out this past week versus how much spiritual leavening did we allow God to fight to put out for us? And again, it's not that we just step back and say, okay, it's all up to you. That's not the case, because we read those verses in Joshua 22 and John 14, and there are many other places that say similar things. keep my commandments. So we have to be doing, but we have to be careful how we approach the battles we're in to allow God to direct them. So let's use an example here. If you want to, we'll be back to this again. If you have a marker there, we'll be back to that section. But let's go to 2 Chronicles. Of all verses to turn to on the last day of unleavened bread, we're going to go to 2 Chronicles. Why are we going to go to 2 Chronicles? Well, we have an account here of a king named Jehoshaphat. Who was Jehoshaphat? Jehoshaphat was the fourth king of Judah after the nation was divided. You had the 10 tribes of the north, two tribes to the south. He was, the king of Judah. And he had a problem because there was a battle coming up. 2 Chronicles 20. Sorry, let me get there. And in verse 17, we pick up the account here. God says to him, "You shall not need to fight in this battle." I'm sorry, what did you say? Don't get entangled in this. And so he says to them, "Position yourselves, stand still." Does that sound familiar? "Stand still and see the salvation of the Eternal, who is with you, O Judah and Jerusalem. Do not fear or be dismayed. Tomorrow go out against them, for the Eternal is with you." Just go stand. Your presence is what I want to see. But it's not just the presence. It's that you're there waiting for me to take care of these things. Because God knows how to do it in the best possible way, at the right time, for the right reasons. And even in things like this where battles are drawn and there are men and animals that die, he can resurrect people, can't he? He can. I don't want to say it flippantly, but he can just flip the switch and they're back to life, and then he picks up where they left off. We can't do that. And so he simply says to him here, what we read back in Exodus, just stand still and see the salvation. And Jehoshaphat didn't know how that was going to play out, but it did play out the way that God said. God took care of it. When we let God fight our battles, that enables us to conquer sin. We don't fight battles to put sin out on our own. We can't. How are we going to do that? Can I make myself more spiritual? I can't. What I can do is provide the means by which God can be more in my life, more a presence, more a guiding force, for him to be able to do the things through me he needs to do. There are about 7 or 8 times, depending on how the language is and how it's translated and so forth, there are about 7 or 8 times just in the Old Testament alone where God says essentially this expression, that I will fight for you. What battles do you need God's help in overcoming? Willpower only goes so far. Because Satan knows the buttons to push, he knows the circumstances to make line up. He knows where the soft spots are. And we're fighting against a spiritual power. What battles do you need God's help in overcoming? And here's another component to encourage us. Let's go to Hebrews 13. One of the unsettling natures, I suspect, that Israel had, and I know that we have at times, is when God says to us to stand still, we don't know where that puts us, right? Where is God? I'm here. Where is God? Because we don't know what he's working out. We don't necessarily see his hand clearly. There's no road map in front of us that says, like Jericho, okay, God says to do this 6 days. On the 7th day, we're going to do it 7 times. The trumpets are going to blow, and then we're all going to shout, and the walls are going to fall down, and we win. In the end, it's like, okay, I know where I'm going. Right? God almost never does that. Because he wants to know if we're going to follow him even when we can't see. Because faith is not faith if we know what's going to happen. And that spiritual component of trusting in him is what he needs to see. That we're not going to rely on ourselves. This is what got Saul into trouble. right? I know better. The people are saying. And he went and did, and Samuel comes up and he says, what did you do? Well, I did all this for God. Okay, then what's all that bleeding of the lambs I hear? Okay, no, you didn't, because they're still alive. So Hebrews 13 and verse 5, we're reminded here, let your conduct be without covetousness, okay? Your trials are not my trials. Your blessings doesn't take anything away from me. You know, we're all part of a body, but don't covet, because that's not us, right? You can't be me. And I struggle to be me at times, right? But this is not a contest. So he says, let your conduct be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have. And living in a materialistic, consumer-driven Western nation, that's a challenge. Because there's all kinds of shiny things out there. But he says, if you're content with those things, you're going to be a lot happier, because joy is not in possessing. And then to bring the point home, he says, for he himself has said, God has promised us, I will never leave you nor forsake you. Stand still doesn't mean that God's then leaving us to go do something else until he has time to come back and help us. Stand still means I'm still here, but I'm going to take care of this in the right way. The times I know, looking back in my life, that I've tried to fix my trials is when they got worse. Because I make more of a mess of it, right? I'm trying to undo it. And I don't even know what it is I'm trying to undo in some cases. And patience is just replete throughout Scripture how important this is. Patience is another way of what God said, stand still and wait to see the salvation of God. Because if we can do that, then he can do his part as well. So let's go back to Exodus 14. And another lesson to consider here is that God is the one who does the work in us. Again, going back to the verses about keeping my commandments, and we have so many other verses that point us to the fact that we have to be engaged. We have to be part of the process. We're not just standing there and recipients of everything that God is bringing. Right, that's a spoiled child. That's not what God is desiring. But we have to allow him to do what he is going to do. If I had been given a vision of what my life would look like right now, when I was 21 years old, I don't know what I would have done with that. Because everything since that time has brought me to this point, hasn't it? All the trials, all the difficulties, all the challenges, but even all the blessings. And the other things that have come along that God, as God has directed me and led me, the last full-time job I had in the private sector, that job I could not have done if I had not had the five jobs before it. And every one of those previous five jobs I lost over the Sabbath or the holy days. But there was some element of each of those positions that last job I had was the best job I'd ever had. Well, you don't know that going into it, do you? 14 years, you're like, okay, God, I'm doing what you ask me to do. You know, I'm trying to stand still here. I'm trying to do my part. I'm obeying your instruction. I'm keeping your laws. And yet I still don't see where you're going. He's like, okay, just stand still. It's still playing out. It's okay. So we come back to that, Exodus 14, verse 13. Do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Eternal, which he has accomplished for you today. So the lesson, to be clear, is, have we seen more clearly this past week the need we should have to stand still so God can deliver us? And again, that's very challenging at times, isn't it? It's very unsettling. You know, because we want to be able to engage in the world around us, right? We're very aware of our senses. We have more than five, but five are the ones that people talk about all the time. So 2 years ago, March, I had taken a trip out to South Dakota as a regional pastor visit. And they had predicted this snowstorm coming across South Dakota. And I looked at the radar. It's like, it should be okay by the time I get to that point. The snowstorm should be done. And those areas of the country, you know, they've got plows. They're out. They're taking care of things. And I thought I'll be okay. Well, I got about an hour out from where I needed to be, and I found myself in the middle of a blizzard. Literally. I don't know how fast I was driving. I was probably doing 2 miles an hour. Because I couldn't see the road. I couldn't see the sides of the road. I couldn't see nothing but snow blowing past me at 30 miles an hour. And I had no idea where I was because I can't sense anything. I can't see anything. And all I had to do was just creep and hope that I stayed on the road until I got to a point where, you know, every once in a while you'd come across the fence line and the wind would break a little bit and you'd say, okay, I can see the road now. But it's very unsettling when you don't know where you're going. And how many times do we know where we're going with what God is doing with us? We're in the middle of a health crisis. We don't know how that's going to play out. We're losing a job when we've still got bills to pay for and things to take care of, obligations, and we don't know how that's going to play out. Life can be going good until the point that it's not. And then we're very unsettled, aren't we? And yet all of this, all that we go through, all that God allows in our life, the good things and the bad things, if you will, are all for our development. Because what is God doing? He's creating a people. Here in this Exodus account, he was creating a people out of the circumstances that nobody else would have said, this is the way I'm going to start a nation. I'm going to start with one man. He's going to have all these children. I've promised him, you know, his descendants are going to be like the stars of heaven. But before then, I'm going to let them become slaves. They're not even going to be in this land. And then I'm going to bring them back as slaves, coming out of a nation. They have no power. They have very little money in the terms of what the world would recognize. They have no resources. You know, they're just a people. And that's who I'm going to work with. Who would have said, well, that's a really great plan. It doesn't make sense from the human perspective, does it? I need to rally troops. I need to get resources. I need to get allies. I need to, you know, all these things I have to line up. And then I have to push through and make sure it happens. And God's like, no, I'm going to take care of it. Manna, we kind of touched around that today. I happened to read about that. Manna, this is another one of those interesting words in Scripture. Most scholars think that manna means what is it? Because they'd never seen this before, right? God provides this. He said he would rain it every morning. It would rain down. Okay, so it's on the ground. Does that mean it picked up sand and dirt as well? Did they have to scrape that part off? I don't know. But they described how it tasted. But, you know, after the first couple of years of this, I mean, how many ways can you cook manna? Boil it, bake it, fry it. I mean, it's just, I don't know, you know, eat it raw. You know, but it's like, hey, Mom, what are we having for dinner tonight? We're having manna. Ooh, you fix such good manna. And yet it wasn't enough, was it? But he provided for them. It says their clothes never wore out. Okay, that would be quite something. And yet they survived, didn't they? Not only survived, they thrived. God led them to the point where he gave them the land that he had promised Abraham. And then the lessons continue, didn't it? Let's go to Philippians chapter 1, verse 6. I mentioned that it can be unsettling to us humanly because we don't always, we rarely, perhaps, see where God is going with us in our life. What is the purpose? Why am I here? Is anything I'm doing of value? And I think if we dwell on those things, that's Satan kind of undermining our confidence in God. Because we have verses such as this. Philippians 1, verse 6. Paul writes here, he says, speaking of God, or himself, being confident of this very thing, that he, God, who has begun a good work in you. Does God ever give up on us? So we read Hebrews 13, where it said that he would never leave us or forsake us. But we even have this here. Being confident of this very thing, Paul says, that God, who has begun a good work in you, will complete it until the day of Jesus Christ. He will complete it. But it's us going through those things with him to learn the lessons. I saw decades ago in my personal life again, not to pray for deliverance for trials quickly. Because I was smart enough, I don't know where I got this, but I was smart enough to realize that if God quickly delivered me from a trial, it would still come back. Right? Because I had not learned what I needed to learn going through that circumstance, whatever it was. So the better thing to pray is, show me what I need to learn. Right? Help me to have the patience in you. Help me to stand still. Help me to do the things that I need to do. This was what Israel forgot. As soon as it got bad, it's like, well, you just want to kill me. Seriously? The Red Sea, did you see that? Did you see the Egyptians die? I mean, can you figure out this manna? I mean, have you seen the things I've done? Yeah, if I wanted to kill you, I'd wait 39 years and then I'd pull the rug out from underneath you. But he's begun this work. He's going to finish this. This is why we're here. This is why God has given us his Holy Spirit. This is why, going back to Revelation, that it says that the Lamb was slain from the foundation of the world. This was always what God wanted to do. He wanted to work with us, all of mankind by extension, to be in his family. What does that mean? We inherit everything God has and everything that God is. I don't know what that means. You know, I look at Hubble space shots, I look at Webb telescope space shots, and it's just, they can't even begin to wrap their minds around some of these things. They've postulated these theories of the origins of the universe, and the more they look, the more they find, we don't have a clue how this all came about. Well, they can't, because it was spiritually started. You know, it was on a spiritual plane that God designed all this. But nonetheless, is that something we're going to do something with? But then Revelation talks about how he burns it all up and starts over. And maybe that's just to show us his majesty and his power and how far it just goes. We'll understand it at some point, I think. But the more important thing is the work that he's begun in each one of us. Will we stick around? It's been noted by so many different business consultants and, you know, these motivational speakers and different ones like this, that for the most part, the number one thing you need to succeed, I'm not asking for a show of hands or a shout out, but do you know what it is? More often than not, the person that succeeds is the person that doesn't quit. They're usually not the brightest. I'm not saying they're stupid. I'm just saying from the world standpoint, right? That's 1 Corinthians 1:26. We're not the world's impression of what will succeed. Because it's just a matter of showing up, of being here on the Sabbath, being here on the holy days, of following God's instruction, going back to John 14, of keeping his instruction. To me, that's a huge lesson of this past week. Because how did they leave Egypt? One foot in front of the other, right? They had to walk out. They had to just do it. There was no Uber rides. There was no taxi service. There was no train to hop on. They had to just do it. And I suspect in their rebellion of having to wander for 40 years, they probably camped at the same areas from time to time. It's like, oh yeah, that's my spot. You know, I remember that. It's close to the water or whatever. But what lessons will we take with us from these days? Will it be a desire to more completely come out of Egypt? Will it be a desire to stand still and see the salvation of the eternal? Will it be trusting in God to have that kind of peace? Right? To just stand. And everybody else is like, what in the world are you doing? You need to do this. You need to do that. You need whatever. And it's like, no, this is where I need to be. And just let God do it. Let's look at a couple of verses here as we wrap up in John chapter 4. As we consider all of this, then what should our worship look like? In John 4 and 24, God says, Christ here says a very simple thing. He's teaching the disciples again. He had gone through the area of Samaria. He had taught the woman at the well. And she was impressed because she recognized that he knew things about her that there was no other way he would have known this unless he was who he said he was. And so then the Sumerians had twisted the worship of God. They were transplants from the Babylonian captivity, the Assyrians and so forth. And so these were part of the Babylonians. And so they had morphed some of their beliefs into God's instruction. They had rejected other things. And part of what they believed was they didn't go to Jerusalem, like was instructed in Scripture, to go before God and his throne on the holy days especially and so forth. They said, these are the mountains we go to right here. We don't have to travel all the way down to Jerusalem. And so Christ addressed this. So in verse 20, this is what she says to him: our fathers worship on this mountain, and you Jews say in Jerusalem is the place where one ought to worship. And Christ basically says, let's hold up a second here. So he says, the hour is coming when you will neither on this mountain or in Jerusalem worship the Father. Right? So back to my point earlier this morning, the physical things are extremely important because they show us a type and they point us. Right? We understand physical things because we're physical. But he says there's going to come a time when that's not it. Right? It's not about Jerusalem. It's not about certain locations. It's not about those physical things. Notice what he says in verse 24. He says, God is spirit, and those who worship him must. That's emphatic, right? Must worship him in spirit and in truth. Okay, so I think it's easier for us to wrap our minds around the truth part, but it's harder to wrap it around the spirit part. Right? Because the truth part, that's a checklist, right? I've got this list. Yeah, I've done that. I'll get back to that one. You know, we can go down, we can reassure ourselves, we can have a guidepost, which is fine on that level. But it has to go deeper, doesn't it? Christ did this with his instruction. The spirit of the law versus the letter of the law, right? It's great you don't kill somebody, but here's the challenge: you can't even hate them. What? He deserves it. Nope, can't go there. And that's the challenge of changing our nature, isn't it? So spirit and in truth. Have we seen that more clearly this past week? 1 Corinthians 5:8 puts it slightly different, but it's the same point. 1 Corinthians 5 and in verse 8. Paul here writes to the congregation in Corinth. He says, therefore, let us keep the feast. And many speculate, if you will, that Paul probably wrote this first letter to the Corinth congregation around this time of year. He's drawing on that analogy, right? It's on their mind. It would be a very easy thing to transition to. And he says, okay, I'm telling you, keep the feast. And the other curious thing is this is about 20 or so years after the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. So this has not been done away with. Paul's still teaching this. But he says, in keeping it, let's not keep it with old leaven. How do you keep old leaven? You don't get rid of it, right? You harbor it. And it can be easy to pick on the Jews at time, and I don't need to necessarily make that the point, but if I was an Orthodox Jew and I don't want to throw out these pizzas that I want to have later, I can go to my Gentile neighbor and say, can you hold on to these for a couple of days? I don't have room in my freezer or whatever. I'll come back and get them next week. That's old leaven, right? They're holding on to it. They completely missed the illustration. They're holding on to it. That's the old leaven. But he says also here, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness, right? That I pretend things are okay, but I'm undermining people. I'm cutting in my comments, or I'm not engaging the way that God expects me to, right? I'm playing the angles. I'm working the margins here. Because Paul says, don't do that either. Rather, with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth, right? Honestly, openly, not pretending here, not going through the motions. I'm engaged. This is sincerity, right? I'm committed. The Greek word here for sincerity means clearness or purity. How do you unleaven bread? After it's leavened, you can't unleaven it, can you? It's permeated everything. You have to start over, don't you? You have to not let the leaven be there. to get purity, you can't have the things that make it not pure. And this is the lesson of leavening, isn't it? Who would have thought they would put it in water? And yet there it is. And it sneaks up on us in other ways. For decades, Triscuits, no leavening. And then I don't know when they changed it, 15, 20 years ago, not all Triscuits, even though they're flat as flat can be, are leaven-free. You got to pay attention. You have to work to make sure that that purity is there. We have to make sure we strive with God's Spirit in us to have that purity, to be reminded. There's always another bit of that onion to peel. But as we read in Philippians 1, God has begun that, and he'll finish it if we work with him. Then in Hebrews 13, he's promised he's not going to leave us. We're not going to be hanging out there. He's going to be part of solving our problems, part of fighting our battles. And so do we see that? After this past week, do we see God clearer? Do we have more of the purity of Christ dwelling in us after this most recent week? Do we see the need to redouble our efforts to do more on our part, but also maybe even to practice more and better standing still and waiting God deliver us? Whatever lessons God has taught us this past week, you and me, let us remember those lessons. Let us remember them as we leave this week, as we move forward, not only physically, but more important, spiritually, the rest of the holy days this year, the rest of our calling, and the rest of our walk before God, so that we too can walk into God's promised land.